This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Urban League of Northwest Indiana is holding another Diversity and Inclusion Symposium. The Fall Symposium is going to be at Valparaiso University this year. And with us to talk about it, we have the CEO and Executive Director of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod, with us. Thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for the invitation. I'm so glad to be able to talk about our symposium that's going to be held October 5th, 2018, from 9 to 2 at Valparaiso University.
The title of it, this year's program, is called Courageous Conversations, Creating a Safe Space. What's that all about?
Well, in order to talk about diversity and inclusion, we have to be courageous, because some people shy away from talking about diversity, inclusion, and ways to increase and enhance that in our workplaces, in our community. So we have to be courageous to talk about it, because nationally there's just been so much backlash and divisiveness in talking about race relations. So we're going to be courageous in having these conversations, and we're going to do it in a safe space. We want people to know that we're not being judgmental in our workshops. We want people to be comfortable in talking about issues regarding diversity and inclusion.
I note that this is a program that's going to invite a number of people from all kinds of professions and types of work in Northwest Indiana, business administrators and human resources personnel, as well as educators, which is why, of course, Valparaiso University is involved in this, and community leaders and churches and all kinds of organizations. These are all people that the Urban League feels are important partners in being able to help spread diversity and inclusion.
We feel it's important, but more so, Chris, these are the agencies that have reached out to us to say, we want to have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We have, not only do we have Valparaiso University, but we have all of the universities, because all of them sit on the Urban League board. Chancellor Lowe from IUN, Chancellor Keon from Purdue Northwest, and President Heckler actually has a seat on our board. So as board members, they understand the necessity of this. We've had this symposium at Purdue for the past 4 or 5 years. This is the first time that we will be at Valparaiso University. And let me tell you, we're already over our numbers from last year.
That's great. That's great. Do you see that this is an opportunity? Of course, folks in Porter County oftentimes will travel over, of course, to Purdue Northwest to attend the events over on campus, or at IU Northwest if they happen to be there. But do you feel that maybe you're getting more folks from Porter County that are involved because it's so close to them?
Well, you know, Chris, I'm not sure exactly what is happening, except I'm happy to know that people want to come and have conversations and dialogues. Let me just give you a couple of the topics that's going to be there. The challenges of providing equity for students in public education. Dr. Tony Lux and Mike Berta will be presenting that. There's another topic, diversity concepts, language. What does it really mean? You know, how do we define diversity concepts and language? And one that I really want to say is undocumented in Northwest Indiana, DACA. Mm-hmm. Attorney Alfredo Estrada of Burke, Conising, and Cranberry. No, I said that wrong. Carberry, LLP.
Okay.
He's going to provide a workshop on what it means to be undocumented in Northwest Indiana. Very important, very important. And then Dr. Stacy Miller, who is the Assistant Provost for Inclusion and Student Success Services at Valpo, she's going to have the noon hour panel discussion.
So it sounds like you have two veteran public school retired superintendents that are involved in the first program there. Then, of course, you'll have an immigration attorney talking about the issues involving undocumented residents in Indiana, mm-hmm. and in Northwest Indiana in particular. And then you've got some folks involved from campus as well, too. And you have an interesting keynote speaker who's not his first time where he's spoken before the Urban League, to be sure. But it's nice to hear from State Senator Eddie Melton. He always has something interesting to say. What's he going to talk about as he gets the day kicked off on the 5th?
Well, Senator Melton has not given me his speech, mm-hmm. and he's not told me exactly what he's going to talk about, But we do know that it's going to be powerful, it's going to be interesting, and he's going to open up, he's going to open up the session of being courageous in our conversations on diversity and inclusion. So many people have heard Senator Melton. I invite people to come out and get a firsthand view of what we're trying to do in the region. You know, Urban League serves Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. So it's beneficial for all of us to take part of this. So people can call us at our office if they have not already registered at 887-9621. That's 887-9621. Or they can go on our website at www.ulofnwi.org for more information or to register.
It's interesting that these programs are always well attended. They have a lot of people from all over Northwest Indiana because, of course, as you mentioned, the Urban League serves not only Lake and Porter but LaPorte counties as well. These folks come in, they want to hear what the speakers have to say, and I'm sure they want to have a chance to network with themselves to talk about what their particular businesses and, mm-hmm. and organizations, nonprofits as well as for-profits, have to say.
Yes.
When you're dealing with a topic like dealing with dialogue on diversity and inclusion and leadership, it's nice to have as many people together as you possibly can to talk about it, isn't it?
It is. And we know that sometimes for some people it's uncomfortable, but that's all right. It should be uncomfortable until we can get to a median, until we can get to a position where we feel comfortable in taking it back. Coming to the workshops, that's one thing, but taking it out into the community and back into your workplace and making some changes, that's what makes the difference.
So once again, this year's Diversity and Inclusion Symposium is going to be happening at Valparaiso University. It's going to happen in the Hare Union Building on Chapel Drive in Valparaiso on campus. It's going to be on Friday, October 5th. Starts at 9 in the morning until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The theme this year is Courageous Conversations, Creating a Safe Space. And it sounds like it's can't be much more safe space at Valparaiso University.
That's right.
than any place else. And thank you very much, Dr. McLeod, for being with us. We appreciate you taking time to talk today.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you.
That's Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod. She's the CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, the sponsor of this year's program. On the first Friday of each month, the congregation at the Temple Adith B'nai Israel in Evansville marks the start of Shabbat with a way that very few other synagogues do. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Isaiah Seibert tells us about the folk rock house band Kippah Groovin', which plays at their Shabbat Rocks service.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, and good evening and welcome. We are
Rabbi Gary Mazo tells his congregation this won't be their usual Shabbat service. Tonight, a handful of the band's founding members, who now live across the country, are back.
This is always where we turn things over to the band.
Most synagogues don't have their own band, but he says that's not the only thing unique about the group.
Tim, who's the drummer, grew up in this congregation, and he was in my confirmation class. He had his bar mitzvah here. But Josh and Eric and Aaron, they're not Jewish.
Most of them aren't Jewish, but Rabbi Mazo says they've become an institution at his congregation.
When the band is playing, that's when most of our people show up. There's kind of something magical that happens when you take ancient liturgical prayers and apply what they do musically to it. It just really makes it more accessible.
Where does the magic come from? The band pulls from a range of genres.
Contemporary Christian music, Beatles and Bob Dylan and Rolling Stones and so on.
The Dire Straits. I love James Taylor, some of those folk singers.
Josh Reedford was first in the band to get involved with music at the synagogue. He took an Intro to Judaism class at the University of Evansville, and his professor, who was rabbi at the time, invited Josh to services. Josh quickly found himself immersed in the congregation.
I met with the music director one afternoon, and he ran through all the music with me in a couple hours, and then he called me up the next day and he said, "Hey, we're all quitting, you're in charge now."
Eric Lund came on board shortly after.
I really only started to do this because there was free food after services.
His candor prompts some honesty from Josh.
If we're doing true confessions here, the only reason I kept coming back is I had a crush on the girl that was singing.
And then Josh's brother Aaron joined in.
I came back because I liked doing the music.
Eric says it took some time for him to learn a new tradition.
There's a language that you have to get an idea of what it means and what its history is and what its purpose is for within the context of the service.
But he got the hang of it. All three are trained musicians, and each has been, or is currently, the music director at the synagogue. Tim Gold hasn't been music director.
If we keep with this pattern, it looks like you're next, Tim.
But he does play drums in the band. He says he grew up with it.
Josh actually performed at my bar mitzvah. He would teach me the songs when I was like 13. He saw me pretty much grow up. I just kind of learned the music, and so it just kind of became a natural progression.
A band played at the Shabbat rock service for years, but the guys say Keep a Groovin' really took off when Rabbi Mazo joined the synagogue in 2013. Eric says their album, Peace and Mercy, seemed like the obvious thing to do.
Once we actually had a band, it was just one of those, well, what's the next step? Well, we gotta make an album.
The songs are adaptations of common Jewish prayers, and the order follows the order of prayers at a Shabbat service. Josh says his time working at a Catholic church throughout high school and college may have influenced his approach to writing music.
I wanted to write songs that would have a nice melody but be easy for congregations to pick up on.
Aaron has also worked at a church. One of his first jobs out of college was playing the piano in a gospel choir.
I went into that job with my degree thinking, oh, I'm a great pianist because I have a degree in piano. And I realized that there are kinds of music that I know nothing about, and I had to learn how to play gospel style for that job.
It's that gospel sound that influenced their adaptation of the Shema, a short prayer that's central in Jewish liturgy.
The Shema came out of me just fiddling. What's one of my favorite things to do is fiddle around on the piano and just like this sort of gospel riff type of style.
They continue to write songs. Most of the band no longer lives in the Evansville area, but when they're back together, they say the music flows. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I would describe homelessness by, it can mean you are living in the streets, you don't have anywhere to go, or you're living from house to house to house, and you don't know when somebody's going to kick you out, you don't know when you might end up on the streets. When you go from couch to couch or house to house, you have no idea when that's going to be the last person. If there's ever going to be any hope that you're going to find your own place or find a job that's going to pay you enough money to get your own place, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, that was my family who was putting me into homeless shelters. I lost my mom when I was 17 and my brother was 14 when we were living in Hammond. She died of cancer. We didn't have a lot of family. We were losing the house that my mom lived in. My mom's husband walked out on us. My brother's dad was a drug addict and couldn't do much for us. Before I turned 18, I went to legal aid and they were able to help me as long as my brother's dad was willing to sign over his rights. And he was. And I took custody of my brother when I turned 18. And we had got some life insurance from my mom in order to get a place, pay the first year's rent, and get him in school and get the furniture and clothes that he needed. It was really hard. We didn't have nobody else. I mean, our situation wasn't that great in the first place, considering my mom was an alcoholic and a drug addict. But when somebody looked at me and said I wasn't going to get custody of my brother, I had to get custody of him. I didn't want to lose my mom and my brother at the same time. It was a lot to take care of. He was a handful, especially after losing your mom. That's a traumatic stage to go through. And I understood because I lost her too, but he took it so much harder than I did that I couldn't wrap my hands around it and I couldn't deal with it because I have my own emotional problems. And I'm like, how am I going to deal with your emotional problems when I have my own? I don't know what to do. And he didn't talk about it. He still does not talk about it to this day. He told me one time, he's like, I think it was better off that mom died. And I was like, why would you say that for? And he was like, because it made us better people. He was like, if we would have stayed with my mom, our mom, then the situation might not have played out the same. She taught us everything not to do. That's the way we look at it. She loved us, but she didn't love herself enough to take care of us the right way like she should have. So she taught us what not to do. And I think we beat statistics pretty well. I had him for a year, and he didn't listen to me so well. I had to put him on probation because he had 80 truancies in school. It was just like two teenagers living with each other and fighting all the time. So he moved in with his friend's mom, and he graduated on honors. But I felt hurt, but I was okay because I knew where he was going, he was going to be okay. I'm very proud of them, and I think my mom would be too. It was after I took custody of my brother. We had our own place, but we lost it. My brother moved out, and then I went to stay with a friend, and I found out I was pregnant. And then that friend's mom kicked me out for no reason. I was 6 months pregnant when she put me out. I lived with her after my mom died, before we had got our own place. And I had got a little bit of life insurance from my mother after she died. And I was able to give her a lot of money at that time. So then when I had moved out and found my own place, and we ran out of money, I moved back in with her, and we didn't have the money no more. And so I was still providing food and cleaning up. It wasn't enough. Then I moved in with my son's father and his sister, and then she left to move to another state. So then I ended up moving in with my aunt, and this is all after I had Jaden. And we lived with her, and then she put me out, and she put me in a homeless shelter. She thought if I lived in a homeless shelter that it would help me get on my feet faster than me living with her. So that was her opinion of it. And not saying it didn't work, but the way she approached it, because she took my stuff and she sold it, or took it somewhere else and gave it to other people. So I was pretty upset. And it was my son's stuff, too, like his walkers, his swings, all of that stuff. She took it, and she just got rid of it because I couldn't come and get it because we were in a homeless shelter. So I think she could have handled that a little bit different.
You can find more original stories at Welcome Project, that's one word, Welcome Project, at valpo.edu. For 10 years, federal laws have required insurance companies to cover mental illness on a par with other medical issues. But as Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman reports, many people still go to extreme lengths to get costly mental health treatments paid for.
Matthew Timian adopted his son when he was just a toddler. He'd come from a home where there were problems with drugs and a lot of violence.
So he was, you know, neglected for the first 3.5 years of his life, whether that means food, medical care.
When his son was 10, he started acting out violently. Timian hid knives or anything in the house that could be used as a weapon. At one point, Timian was bringing his son to the hospital every few weeks. They had good health insurance, so he didn't expect coverage would be an issue, but at times it was.
He was cutting himself, and he's hearing voices, and he is threatening to run away and kill me. Insurance company says, well, hasn't done that in 3 or 4 days now. He's good to go home. And the hospital said, no, he has to stay.
To get an insurance company to pay, patients can file an appeal. But if the internal reviewer agrees the treatment isn't needed, the patient's on the hook for the bill. This happened to Timian, so he appealed to the state agency that regulates insurers, and they said,
yeah, he clearly needed to be at the hospital. You're paying for it. And so in our case, it worked out. But most people don't have the tenacity to go through this process.
Especially if they're in the middle of a crisis with their child. Side Effects reached out to Timian's insurance company at the time, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. They declined an interview but sent a statement saying that the level of care they cover is based on medical necessity. That includes looking at national guidelines and the needs of individual members. David Lloyd is a senior policy advisor for the mental health advocacy group, the Kennedy Forum.
In many cases, it is pretty clear that treatment is needed and that coverage is just not being provided.
And that, Lloyd says, is a potential violation of federal law. 10 years ago, Congress enacted the Mental Health Parity Act. The law doesn't force insurers to pay for all mental health treatments, but they have to cover mental and physical health equally. When coverage is denied, it can have dire consequences on families like Matthew Timian's.
My son fell through so many cracks that the system was supposed to protect.
On two occasions, Timian almost gave up his parental rights in a last-ditch attempt to get the state to pay for the treatment. Data from Illinois shows about 100 kids a year enter state custody because it was the only way parents could access mental health treatment for them. John Foley is the CEO of Benefit Consulting Group in the Chicago suburbs. He helps employers create benefits programs. He says as healthcare costs rise, insurers don't want to spend money on expensive treatments that aren't absolutely necessary.
Now you've got the payer side, we're going to spend $600,000. But is there another way to treat this so that maybe this can be handled for $75,000 and get the same outcome?
Foley says sometimes what's medically needed is obvious. If someone breaks a bone, they need a cast. But with mental illness, it's not always as clear-cut. He says there are also financial incentives on both sides. Providers make more money on expensive treatments. Insurers save money by denying that same care.
Providers are not angels, and neither are the payers. I just want to make that clear. Neither side is, shall we say, virtuous.
That's why advocates say regulators need to step up and do a better job enforcing existing laws. Matthew Timian did get a state grant to cover his son's treatment after his insurance stopped paying. Without it, he would be hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. Timian says he's grateful, but he worries about parents who aren't as lucky.
Most of these parents I talk to, you know, they're looking at their kids ending up in jail soon or dead because that's just how bad the behaviors are getting.
His son is now 15. He just moved back home to Northern Illinois after a year and a half at a residential facility in Missouri. Timian says his son is much better, but there's still a long road ahead.
Success isn't being cured. That's ridiculous. It's becoming able for these kids to actually be happy again.
And giving them a shot at a better life. I'm Christine Herman. Side Effects Public Media.
This story is part of a podcast from Side Effects Public Media called The Workaround, and there is a link to the show at sideeffectspublicmedia.org. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We have some good news for viewers of Lakeshore PBS. We've had some problems lately, but we're working very slowly but diligently to take care of them. We get an update on how the transmitter and tower are coming along. We've mentioned before in previous conversation, we have in studio with us James Muhammad, the president and CEO of Lakeshore Public Media. James, thanks for being with us today.
And thank you, Chris, for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it always seems that we have you in here for a very important time. The last time was for the fall membership campaign,
true,
which is important.
Yeah.
And this time, too, it's again with an update talking about the Lakeshore Public Television, Lakeshore PBS's transmitter and the tower situation. Will you briefly tell us about the problems? And in fact, if you want to get the conversation on that end of it, as it started, there's a video that is also on Lakeshore PBS website you can check out too. Bring us up to date with first of the problem then as it began and some of the issues along the way to where we get today.
Well, first off, I'd like to thank our viewers and citizens of Northwest Indiana in particular for their patience, but also because Lakeshore PBS serves the entirety of Chicagoland, we're very thankful to the Chicagoland community for all of their support. So this has been a very long process for us that began on July 16th when storms came through the area of Northwest Indiana where our transmitter is located, which is an incorporated portion of Crown Point, mm-hmm, very close to Cedar Lake, actually. Around 1:30 that afternoon on July 16th, power went off, and we experienced what we believe is a power surge. But around 3:30 in the afternoon on July 16th, power did come back on, and we noticed when we tried to power up and our engineer power up, and it's a slow process because of the massive amount of power it takes to transmit from our location, that we had some failures in the transmitter itself. So from July 16th through the 30th, we went through a process of diagnosing what the issue would be and exploring options, and discovered that given that our transmitter is roughly 15 years old, that the extensive amount of repairs required to get it up and running wouldn't be worth it in light of the fact that it was approaching what we call end of life within less than 2 years. And that basically means parts will no longer be available or be manufactured, and services will either not be available at all or significantly diminished. And mm-hmm. that starts to happen before you actually reach that date. So from the 16th through the 30th, we did the diagnosis and determined on July 30th, okay, we're just going to purchase a transmitter, and we did that on July 30th. Our loaner transmitter came in on August 2nd, and when that was delivered, and that's kind of the low-power transmitter that's operating right now.
Uh-huh.
And so in working on that on the 2nd, it took a couple days to get it going. We noticed that we only needed a few more parts to get it installed on the 2nd. So all transmission was operating properly on the 3rd. We noticed that we had experienced some acts of vandalism and other things that came about over the following days. With that, we're in what's called the repack that's following the Spectrum auction. So kind of reassigning places on Spectrum not sold. And so we find that that Spectrum, those stations that are involved in that, have contracted with all of the companies that are buying transmitters and the tower climbers and all that, and they've taken all of the equipment. So testing equipment and all that stuff took quite a amount of time. So, you know, kind of leads us up to a point where we notice we have transmission line issues and not able to find tower climbers. And we were able to luckily get one on yesterday that was contracted to be in Wisconsin, but because of rain, they were able to come down to us because we had called just about all certified tower climbers for the company that we lease from, and they were able to come down yesterday and get us on the air and make necessary repairs so that we could restore service at much lower power until we're able to get our full power transmitter, which arrives on Wednesday, up and running. And that'll take about 2 weeks.
And so once that comes in, once it gets delivered out to the transmitter site, and then it's just a matter of getting the engineers to put it in place and take the low power tower transmitter off and reconnect in the regular transmitter to take the job over then.
Yes. And I'll have to say what's taken the most time is the fact that this repack of and I believe there's 5 or 6 stages in which stations are assigned to meet deadlines for their new channel assignments on current Spectrum. The tower climbers are all booked, and they've been booked for months, and so we had to get into a hole in their schedule. So we're very fortunate that we're able to get this company down here. But under normal circumstances, 2 weeks would have been a long time to deal with all of this stuff. We would have had this going much faster, but it took us almost 2 weeks to acquire a piece of testing equipment that we had to beg for and finally got from a company out of Washington, D.C. They were like, okay, we're done with it. We'll send it over to you.
Mm-hmm.
So
so we have the low-power transmitter up now. And so,
sure.
And so viewers get to see, for the most part, almost all the viewers get to see some signal, I guess, from Lakeshore
yes.
PBS.
So we're on all Comcast, all the cable providers, satellite, except for RCN in Chicago, which the head end to reach that signal is so far from us. We need our full power transmitter.
And hopefully that will come very soon.
Yes.
Now, I guess looking to the future now, we get the transmitter in, get it back up in a full power mode, and any contingency plans in the hopes that Mother Nature doesn't give us another hand of bad cards again?
Yeah, well, looking forward, there are things that we want to do. We're nothing I can share right now, but
right.
Looking
process,
at strengthening our infrastructure and some partnerships to do that within Chicagoland to make our service more reliable because it's a very expensive proposition.
Well, James, thank you for being in with us today to give us the latest here about the Lakeshore PBS transmitter, the tower, all the work that's done, and the signal that's now back available for folks on cable as well as most of them over the air,
I guess,
to be able to pick up the TV signal as well, too.
Yes.
And we'll keep everybody apprised as the information comes in.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking. Joakima Hiller is involved here at Purdue University Northwest, except she got her degree from Purdue University Calumet. And we'll find out more about that in a moment. As a professional in the hospitality industry, and she's had a lot to learn over the years, and she's been able to put all that learning to good use. She has written 3 books, all of which are available online if you'd like to check them out. And she's had to deal not only with a great deal of change in her professional life, but unfortunately in her personal life as well, too. And we're going to find out more. Joachima Hiller, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit first about yourself professionally. How did you make it all these years in the hospitality industry? You started out, I guess, at a very young age, I understand.
Yes. Actually, I'm an Army brat and traveled quite extensively with my family. And I remember leaving the hotel room for the day and then coming back later on and realizing that the bed had been made. And I vividly remember asking my mom, what happened? Who made our bed? You didn't make us make the bed this morning, not realizing that there was an entire department, you know, called housekeeping, that was their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would go down for breakfast in the morning, and then we would leave, and I would go, oh, Daddy, you didn't pay for breakfast, not realizing that because of the type of hotel it was, the rate of the breakfast was included in the overall hotel stay. So to me, hotels very early on began to represent magic, where things would happen and I wouldn't have any idea as to how they occurred. So probably as early as 10, if someone had asked me, what do you want to be, young lady, when you grow up, I would say that I wanted to work in a hotel. And I got that opportunity when I was about 15 years old. And I've never looked back.
Now, you have taken on what jobs over the years now, working in hotels and in the hospitality industry?
Sure. At 15, I was very fortunate to start out in the human resources department of a full-service hotel, so I got a chance to learn the different positions, work in most of the different departments to learn a little bit more, and then I transitioned after graduating from college into management and became the assistant reservation sales manager for the Radisson Hotel at Star Plaza that used to be in Merrillville, Indiana. And there I got a chance to actually work with entertainers as well. And then I transitioned to the front office department as front desk manager. And then I was afforded the opportunity to assist in the opening of Trump Hotel Casino as the front office manager. And then I got out on the road and became a traveling trainer for a global hotel company and got a chance to go all over the world, Hong Kong, Canada, all throughout the United States, Paris. And then I became an aunt, and I wanted to come back and settle down at home so that I could make an impact in their life. And so I began managing, or helped open and manage, the Country Inn and Suites in Portage, Indiana, and worked there for about a year, and then transitioned to working or taking over a hotel in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I transitioned into education.
And you became, I guess, what I guess best called a hospitality educator. What kind of job did you have a chance to be able to do in that particular role?
Sure. In Indianapolis, there was a culinary college, and the students could get an associate's degree in culinary arts. And what happened is they started to get out into the industry and realized that they needed more. They needed more education. They needed a bachelor's degree. So I was recruited to help begin the bachelor's program for this culinary college, where students could walk out of that degree with their background not only in culinary arts, but then in the business education classes within hospitality, and go into management to continue their career. And then when I decided to go back to college myself and pursue my doctorate, I realized that a good environment for me would be at the university level, and that's when I relocated to Springfield, Missouri.
Now, we mentioned at the start of our conversation that you're the author, co-author, I guess, because you've had an assistant who's worked in the hotel industry, Jill Woods, with you on the books. You had 3 books that you've worked on. The first one, I understand, was one that was very specifically designed for people who are either learning the hospitality industry or they're actually working in it on a daily basis. And it's a very important guide, I think, that helps out. First, tell us a little bit about that book.
sure. It's called the RevPAR formula. And Jill and I worked at the last hotel that I managed there in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And boy, did we have some challenges. And so when she took over as general manager, we at this point had bonded so that and been through so much that we were really good friends. And so one day we thought, oh my goodness, all the stories we have, all the experiences we have, we should write a book. And we sat down at her kitchen table and we mapped out a guidebook, the RevPAR formula, which really the formula is optimizing challenging circumstances plus always driving retention equals an increase in revenue per available room. Mm-hmm. So if you really take those challenges that you are given and we map out 10 of those challenges based on what was going on at the time in the industry, if you take those challenges and you really work on retaining your employees and turning those challenges around, then you will have an increase in a monetary increase, your revenue per available room, which is a hotel concept that we have. Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that first book came out in April of 2011. In May of 2015, you and Jill got together and you worked on a second book, which is entitled Seven Easy Ways to Show Your Employees You Care. Because obviously you had a chance not only to take all the experience that you had in the hospitality industry, but the experience that you had working in the personnel side, I guess, the human relations side in all this, too.
Yes.
What did you be able to meld together from everything that you learned to be able to create the second book?
Sure. Well, what happened with this one is I had relocated to Missouri, and now I have students at this time. So in my conversations with my students and then also reconnecting with my colleagues back in Indianapolis, it seemed like every conversation I had would end with either the student or my colleague saying, oh, man, you know, I love my job, but I really wish someone cared. I really wish my supervisor cared about me. And that just really got to me. I mean, it got to my heart, and I thought, what can I do with that? I feel like there's something I should be doing with that information. And so one day I thought, why don't I write a love letter to all of the other managers that are out there? And so seven easy ways to show your employees you care is sort of like my message, my personal message, my love letter to all the other managers that are out there saying, hey, I know you're working hard, but we've really got to make sure that we make an impact in the lives of the employees that we have. And here's how. I map out seven ways to go about doing that, mm-hmm. to make them feel cared for, to make them feel special.
Now, finally, the latest book that is out there, and by the way, we should mention, too, that all three of the books are available on Amazon.com. The latest book is entitled The Red Book, Notes from a First-Year General Manager. And I understand in this latest book, you and Jill get together, and you're able to really, really tear the facade off. You know, you're unmasking an awful lot of things that people that maybe that even are currently working in the hospitality industry don't really know about, because these are things that you experienced in the first year that you had to work as a hotel manager.
Yes, this one is very different from our first one. It's not a guide. It's just really a compilation of the experiences that we had together, some separately. But we have created a character named Jackson. And Jackson graduates from college, and he has his first interview for a general manager's job out in the industry. And he receives it. He gets the job. And so we map out his first year in management as that general manager, and we tell everything. So each of the stories and the experiences that Jackson incurs are actually true stories that have happened with Jill and I. And it gets pretty wild. We really have had situations, just to give you a little insight from the book, is, you know, we've had to deal with guests who have passed away in the room. So we tackle that, and I know in just speaking with my students, that's something that they don't ever think about. And I'm going, you know, that's why we did the book, because we want everyone to know that these are things that we handle. Mm-hmm. Also, we take it from the perspective that when you work in the service industry, unfortunately, the public thinks that you are not knowledgeable, that you're not intelligent. But when you think about everything that we have to know to run a hotel, we have some pretty intelligent people from, you know, the chemistry side on how to mix chemicals in the housekeeping department to, you know, customer service to how to handle, you know, your swimming pool area and complaints. So, you know, we're not just, you know, people who are cleaning rooms. We clean rooms and we do a whole list of other things as well.
It's interesting that you should bring up in the book and your experiences here about the unfortunate incident of a guest passing away in a room, because we know that if you're a fan of Monty Python's Flying Circus and you remember John Cleese, who was one of the key members of the group, he went on, of course, to come up with an entire series of his own that got its own famous role in television, Fawlty Towers. And he was able, he and his co-writer, who at the time was his wife, came up with this episode of a guest dying in a room, and what Basil Fawlty does to try to get around all that and not let anybody else know something bad happened. So,
right.
So that was taken from real life too. Just as I understand that that apparently Mr. Fawlty, or I guess Mr. Cleese actually came up with when they created that particular episode. So yeah, so there's all kinds of interesting things I can see that you deal with in real life in the hospitality industry, and it's only fair that people starting out in the industry or people that are just outside the industry need to know about what goes on within the four walls of a hotel.
Yes, definitely.
Now, you mentioned you're now a hospitality instructor at Missouri State University. You're able to bring things together. But, of course, you got your college experience with Purdue University Calumet, the Hammond campus, in the program, which many people know as RHI, which is Restaurant, Hotel, Institutional, and Tourism Management. One of the things that I know in particular that the campus tries to deal with is trying to get students involved, and you had this opportunity, of course, in real life by learning, by doing, working in the hospitality industry, is to come up with ways to be able to teach future students things that they need to know. Maybe they won't have the benefit of getting to work in a hotel, but in the future, the university, I know, is working on a way to take advantage of some of its most famous property down at West Lafayette, the Union Club Hotel, which is in the Purdue Memorial Union Building on the main campus, and they're going to do some major expansion. And one of the things they talk about they want to do in that expansion project is what you, I'm sure, are very much familiar with is experiential learning. Tell us what you feel experiential learning is and how maybe you, in your view, what Purdue wants to do down in West Lafayette will fit in well down there.
Sure. First, I just want to say thank you to the White family for making such a donation. I think any opportunity we have to provide experiential learning for students, that it is a really wonderful thing to do. One of the things that is still what I call king or queen in the hospitality industry is experience. So one of the things that Jackson in the Red Book, the latest book that I have published, experiences is that once you graduate from college, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are qualified to be a manager or a supervisor in the hospitality industry. And that's because your employer is still going to look for experience. Have you cleaned rooms? Have you cooked something in a kitchen? Have you managed a kitchen? Have you had your hands on the actual thing that you'll be doing in the industry? And then have you interacted with customers? And so in the classroom, whether it is, you know, in a culinary class or even in an introduction to lodging management class, we try to provide students an opportunity to actually do those things. For example, in my special event planning class, my students get a chance to actually make invitations, you know, to actually do the things that they would be responsible for doing in planning an event.
Mm-hmm. Very
and so I think, you know, the White family should be applauded by providing that opportunity with, you know, the hotel there in West Lafayette. It only enhances the educational impact for those students and provides them an opportunity to be like Jackson in the Red Book, which is to step right into a management position now that he has his education and he's had experience by having an internship.
We're talking with Dr. Joachima Hiller. She is a professor in hospitality and is a graduate of Purdue University Calumet. And she got her master's in business administration from Keller Graduate School of Management. And you've been working, of course, now making it up the academic ladder and working as a professor in other states and your other experience as well, to be able to put all that together and work very hard to get your PhD, which I know is the ultimate goal that anybody that has made it so far out of graduate school with a master's, they want to make that next step for in their career and financially as well as professionally. And you have had a number of personal problems along the way. Tell us a little bit about some of these that have seemed to have slowed you down, I guess, in trying to be able to achieve that PhD.
Sure. I started working on my doctorate in about 2013 from the advice of my professors at Purdue. They said, you know, if you want to continue if you want to continue working at the university level, you really need to have a doctorate.
Right.
And so I started in 2013 as a distance doctoral student through Iowa State University. They have an awesome program. And right about a year or two into the program, I became ill. And one of the results of my illness was having my right leg amputated above the knee. So I don't have a knee. And it really not just slowed me down, but it changed every single aspect of my life. And I went from not wanting to live without a leg to, you know, working my way to thinking, okay, maybe I can do this and maybe I can be useful and maybe I can get back on my educational journey and get my doctorate. And just a couple of days ago, I got the final word from my major professor at Iowa State saying I had met all of the conditions for my doctorate. So I'm feeling really good right now.
Wow, I would imagine so. Yes, that's great. Now that you've gotten the word that you're going to actually get your PhD degree, when do you get to wear the gown and the cap and actually go through the ceremony to get that, much as I hate to say it, the sheepskin, you know? When do you get that diploma in hand?
It will be this fall. Now, I probably won't participate in the commencement exercises, but I have a very large family, and so I want to do some sort of graduation party or open house. And I want to do it in three different cities. So I'm probably going to do something here in Missouri, and then I'll probably go to Indianapolis, where I ended my career in a hotel there.
Right.
So I'd love to do something with my colleagues there to celebrate. And then I got to go home. So I'll probably do something in Gary, Indiana as well, so that my parents can participate.
That's great. Joachima, if there is anything in particular, and you've done a lot of this, and obviously you've actually put it in writing because you've written three books that detail a lot of this information. If there is something that you could pass along to somebody who is interested in the hospitality industry, and maybe somebody, as we said, maybe somebody who's out there in the trenches right now on the front line, they're either at the front desk or they're somebody working back in the kitchen or they're a housekeeper or in some other task that's part of the hotel business, what would you tell them?
Sure. You know, I probably have two really key pieces of advice that helped me sustain a 20-plus year career in the industry. And the first thing is you've got to really love people. Not necessarily like them, because they're going to test you, not only from a coworker and employee and supervisor standpoint, but from a guest standpoint. You just really got to love people. That's got to be the core from which you operate, so that when things do go wrong, you can still maintain your decorum, because it's the very base of things. You know, you have a genuine love and care for people. And then the second thing is, when things really get tough, you need to be able to reconnect with your reason why. Why did you get into the hospitality industry? You know, what brought you here? And I know for me, I can always go back to being that little girl who returned at the end of the day and said, "Oh, Mom, who made the bed? How did that happen?" That little girl is still in me, and she is what drives my passion for the industry for today. So I think that would be my two key pieces of advice. You got to love people, or you won't last very long in this people-driven industry. And then secondly, you've got to always be able to reconnect with your reason why you got into the industry. What's driving your passion?
Well, I guess it shows that you come full circle from those thoughts. Whether you say when you were a little girl and you saw the mystery of how a bed was rumpled the night before and is nice and clean and neat today.
Yes.
And how that has changed and turned into a career, and with all the problems along the way that you've been able to turn that around into not only being a successful educator, but also a successful author with three books out there, the latest of which is entitled The Red Book, Notes from a First-Year General Manager. And all three books that you have worked with Joe Woods on out there available and at Amazon.com. If you're interested, if you're sincere about wanting to be in the hospitality industry, you got to get all three copies, because I'm sure that you're going to learn something very important from what you get out of all three. Joachima Hiller, thanks very much for being with us. It's been a very, very interesting conversation, and the best of luck to you in the future, especially as you're being an official professor now, I guess, or a full-fledged professor coming up here with receiving your PhD soon, and for everything that you have done in your life and be able to teach young people coming up through the ranks and the importance of helping other people in such an important industry as the hospitality industry. Thank you for being with us to talk about today.
Thank you so much.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll have tomorrow a conversation with Karen Toering about the 8th Annual Gary International Black Film Festival, which is coming up in Gary in just about 2 weeks from now. We hope you join us for that conversation.